Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the K-12 Finance Education Committee meeting. I am going to go ahead and call this meeting to order. We do have a quorum right now, and remote hearings are held in accordance with Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members, you should have all the contents of the virtual packet available to you. And for the public, these materials have also been posted online. Members, if you're looking for these items in one place, they are all attached in the calendar event that Ms. Burt sent to you today. And to get on the list to be recognized by the chair, please go ahead and use your raise hand function, which I believe now is located under the reactions tab. And you can certainly, if you are on your cell phone, you can certainly email Ms. Burt to get on that list. And again, I want to keep this hearing as customary or traditional to what we're used to in in-person meetings. So if I'm not calling on you, it's probably because I don't see your hand. Feel free to speak up. And I will go ahead and call on you as soon as I recognize you. And with that right now, I think we are going to take our call or our roll. So Ms. Sunderland, will you please take the roll?
All right, we have Chair Dabney excused for the start. Vice Chair Sandstead?
Present.
Representative Kreisha?
Kreisha is present.
Representative Bennett?
Present.
Representative Daniels? Representative Daniels? Representative Damuth?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Drazkowski? Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Marquardt is excused. Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Thompson?
Representative Thompson present.
Representative Wolgamott is excused. Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang. Representative Joachim.
Present.
I'm going to come back to Representative Daniels.
Rep. Daniels is working on logging in right now.
Perfect. Representative Drazkowski. I see him on the screen here. And Representative.
You don't hear from me by.
Representative Zhang. And that is the roll.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. A quorum is present. Representative Bennett, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from Tuesday, January 12th? And if so, would you like to move them?
Madam Chair, I shall move the minutes.
Thank you very much. Representative Bennett moves our minutes. Are there any objections? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from Tuesday, January 12th, please say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed, say nay. Very good. The minutes will be placed on file. And moving forward in our agenda, today and tomorrow's hearings will consist of overviews from House Research. Today we'll be hearing from the committee's two legislative analysts, Mr. Strom and Ms. Para, as well as from our fiscal analyst, Ms. Adrians. Members, again, please feel free to ask questions as we move through these materials. It's helpful for all of us and for the public to hear your questions and the answers from House Research. We'll be starting with the PowerPoint, and we will toggle back and forth between this presentation and the various runs that Mr. Strom has prepared and Ms. Adrian's tracking sheet. I believe Ms. Para is getting us started today. So Ms. Para, please introduce yourself and for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christina Para from House Research. And I will be starting us off on the presentation for today. I'll be working with my colleagues, Tim Strom and Emily Adrians. And just give that a minute. There we go. Okay. Let me just start out with an outline of where we'll be going today. First, I'll tell you a little bit about what the nonpartisan staff here do with the committee. Talk to you about some principles of school finance, some context for school funding in Minnesota, including where school funding fits in to the broader state budget. Talk to you a little bit about how we count pupils and what that means for state funding, the major components of our state school finance system. And then we'll end with student movement programs and how that fits into school finance system. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped. Let me tell you a little bit about ourselves. As you've heard, we are part of the nonpartisan staff. We work with the committee on drafting bills, tracking sheets, doing research on various school K-12 programs. We work with all members on a confidential basis. We also staff the committees. So normally we would be sitting at the table with members answering any questions that the committee had as the committee heard bills or heard presentations. And that's our contact information that you see right there. So that's the best way to get a hold of us. Reach out at any time with any questions. And we do hope you'll ask questions as we go through today, or certainly feel free to reach out after committee anytime with any questions. Those are our websites that you see right there. We have lots of publications on our websites. And there are two different sites. One is for House Research and one is for House Fiscal. And the Fiscal page has more of the tracking sheets, and there's lots of great info there about all areas of the budget, but particularly education, which Ms. Adrians will talk to you about. And we also have two school finance guidebooks on the websites. They're a little bit different from each other, but they have lots and lots of great information and background on all aspects of the school finance system. So that's the finance guide for legislators. That's what that looks like on our website. And it was just updated back in November, so very up to date. And as you go through it, it has details on things like special education, concurrent enrollment, PSEO, different aspects of the, there you go, you can see there's a table of contents there. So again, feel free to ask questions about any of those, but if you ever want to just get sort of an overview of things, that's a great place to start, or if you want a little more information about anything in particular, say American Indian programs and how those are funded, again, that's a great resource. So services that we provide to the committee, we do bill summaries. So every time the committee hears a bill, there would be a summary in your packet. It's also posted online on the revisor page. When you go into the bill page, there's a link there for a bill summary that you can always click on for the bills that have been heard in committee. We work with members on amendments. So that's when the bill is being heard either in committee or on the floor. We can work with you to prepare those. We do overviews of the different programs that are within the jurisdiction of the committee. Some historical overview. We can talk to you about how the program has evolved over time. We also have the fiscal tracking spreadsheets. And we can provide district by district printouts and examples of the different funding programs. So hopefully you'll get a sense of some of those things as we go through the presentation today. We, you know, school finance systems, we also often think about certain characteristics. Are they, is funding adequate? Is it equitable, efficient, effective, stable, transparent? So as you think about those principles, those goals, we can provide lots of information to help you evaluate the different programs and whether they're accomplishing those goals and think about different trade-offs between those goals and principles. And our school funding system is created by the legislature. There are a number of formulas, and when you combine all of those, school districts, you'll see, are funded by state aid, local property taxes, federal funds, and fees and other local sources of revenue. So we'll be talking to you about each of those, and I will turn it over to Ms. Adrians.
Ms. Adrians, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Emily Adrians, and I am with the House Fiscal Staff. And so good morning to all of our members and the chair. What we're going to start with, so this chart is showing kind of a high level view of where the school funding comes from before we drill down in some of the details of the state funding. So for the current school year, which is the 2021 school year, we also will refer to that as fiscal year 21. The funding from all of the sources for schools is, you can see here, it's just over $15 billion. Almost 70% of that is from the state, but the schools also receive funding through other sources like local property taxes, fees, and the schools get some federal funding as well. I think Ms. Burt is going to take us next to a chart. So Ms. Pera referenced some of the runs by district that Mr. Strom produces. And so this is one version of that. And so what this shows you is the total school district revenue from all sources. So this is the money that the schools receive from the state, from local sources, and from federal sources as well. And we will try to orient you to how to read some of these documents a bit more later as we go through. But what this shows you is it lists all of the school districts, and it will include charter schools as well. And sometimes we list the districts in numerical order, so starting, you know, with 1, 1.3, 2, and so forth. In this chart, they are listed the school district that has the highest amount of total revenue in the all funds, and this is showing per pupil. So you can see at the very top, it's showing, it's kind of aggregating the regions. So it combines Minneapolis and St. Paul, then the inner ring suburbs, the outer ring suburbs, and then greater Minnesota, and then the charter schools. And then below that, it lists all of the districts. And I don't know, Mr. Strom might wanna chime in about this for a minute as well.
Madam Chair. Members, the spreadsheet is one example that Ms. Adrians put on the screen is one example of a way we can look at school funding. We try to make sure our documents are accessible, so we post PDFs for the committee purposes, but we can always send the spreadsheet file off to folks to sort, as Ms. Adrians said, however they'd like. This one sorted from most to least funding per district. And a couple of points to make about this, and we'll get to this more when we talk about students, but Minnesota has 330 school districts and about 185 charter schools, and they're all very different. Some are very, very small, some are quite large. If you look in the first column of data there on the district pupil count, we often refer to that as average daily membership, you can see that the first district listed the highest spending or the highest revenue district in the state, Princeburg, number 815, only has 9 pupils. So it's no surprise that that in this definition of pupil, it's no surprise that the funding per pupil may look quite different than other districts. You can then see a number of charter schools. All the charter schools have school district numbers in the 4,000s. And you can see there that there's a few of the charter schools that have very high funding as well. Those charter schools tend to be the ones that serve primarily a population with high special education needs. And you can see very quickly how that list of total funding for pupil drops by school district. And so always when you look at a printout, one thing to keep in mind is that there are outliers almost always, and averages and regional totals at top are sometimes a better way to think about what's happening. The fact that one school district shows up with very high or very low funding often speaks to some very special characteristics of that district. But Madam Chair and members, this is an example of a type of printout. This is showing revenue for a year that's over and done with. So this is final, not estimated data. And it's a file we can provide you all, and you can sort and you can look at revenue by characteristic or by source if you want to see by federal funds or state funds or what level is pushing that district to where it is on the list. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it back to Ms. Adrians.
Members, at this time, before we go back to Ms. Adrians, I just want to do a quick check-in. Are there any questions to this point? And just go ahead and speak up. Okay, I am not seeing anything yet and not hearing anyone. Why don't we go ahead and proceed? Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we do acknowledge that we're giving you a lot of information. So even if you all have questions later on, please feel free to contact us or interrupt us later on in the presentation as well. So this chart is, now we're drilling down a bit more into the general fund dollars. And so here we're looking at the state general fund and all of the sources that the state has for revenue. So this, you can see that the individual income tax makes up the largest chunk. It's about 46%. The sales tax is the next largest at 21%. And then there's a fund balance carry forward from the previous year that kind of makes up the next biggest chunk. But so the state has, and this is showing fiscal year 2021, just over $27 billion to spend. So then on the next chart, what this shows is how the state spends this money. And so you can see that where the general fund dollars are going, the bulk of the money is going to K-12 education. So just over, so about 42% of that money goes into the education system. Health and Human Services is next at 28%. And then you can see how it's distributed to some other areas. Now, I just want to mention that if this chart were showing all funds, so if it included federal funds and all other sources that the state has for money, in that case, the Health and Human Services tips over education. So Health and Human Services gets more of the funding when we're looking at all of the funds. But when we're just talking about what the legislature has the most direction over, which is the state general fund, K-12 education is the bulk of that spending. So as we said, 42% of the state's general fund budget goes towards schools. This is 42% of all of the revenue that the state is bringing in. The state aid, it's the biggest share of each of the school districts' budgets. So the school districts have a couple of sources of revenue, and the state aid makes up just about 70% of the school district's total revenue. We will show you what the tracking looks like here in just a second. But we wanted to point out that there are more than 50 different state aid formulas. So it's quite a complex way for the school districts to get funding. But even though we have so many different formulas, the bulk of the funding is distributed through the general education fund formula and through special education. So both of those two things, that makes up about 90% of the school district aid. So the the all the different formulas, it's sort of tinkering with the money, if you will. But the bulk of it goes out through those two formulas. And so the tracking worksheet, I think Ms. Burt will take us to that. This is when we talk about the spreadsheet and going through the spreadsheet, this is the document that we will use throughout the legislative session. And what it shows is, and it has a lot of numbers on it. Please don't feel too intimidated by it. What it is showing is all of the programs and the grants that are funded in the education bill. So you can see all of those things are listed in the program column on the left right there. The numbers that will be shown in the spreadsheet are in thousands. So what that means is if you look at the very first column where it says November forecast 2020, and you go down to row 16 and you look at the general education base. So for that year, it looks like it's about 7.3 million, but actually it's 7.3 billion. So that's what I mean when I say that the numbers are in thousands, that they're that we're leaving off those last zeros just to make it a bit more manageable to put all the numbers in the spreadsheet and the tracking. All of the numbers that are shown in this spreadsheet are considered the base numbers. So it's really the starting point for the legislature in making the decisions for how to fund all of these different programs. Let me show you one more thing too. The numbers that are on that row just above the general education base. So where it says formula allowance and age shift percentage. So the per pupil formula allowance for the fiscal year 2022 that will be coming up, it's $6,567 per pupil. So this is the current ongoing amount that is set in law for that basic formula allowance. And then right underneath that, you can see it says 90% and 10%. This is the aid payment shift percentages. So what this means is that school districts are paid out 90% of the entitlement money, so the amount that the formulas come up with. So they get 90% of that in a current year, and then they get 10% of the previous year's final payments. So this gets a little bit confusing, but I think just what you need to know is that we're currently at that 90-10 payment shift, and that the legislature can change it and has in the past. So sometimes to accommodate when there are budget problems and funding needs to be cut, that's one of the tools that the legislature has. We typically use the November forecast numbers. These are based on economic projections that are produced by Minnesota Management and Budget. So that's the majority of the numbers that you'll see in here come from the November forecast. The numbers, we typically compare them to the end of session. So the end of session after June 30th, those would be sort of the actual numbers from the previous legislative session. And I don't have what I compare them to in this year. So if you look at column M, it says the difference between November and October. Typically, we compare it November to the end of session. But there was an update to some of the actual numbers in October due to legislation that was passed throughout the ongoing special sessions that we had. So that's sort of the most recent update before the November forecast. And actually, let me talk about the columns. Since there are so many big numbers, it's kind of nice to just look at the gray shaded columns, because that gives you an idea of how the funding is changing from one biennium to another.
Madam Chair.
Adrians? Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Adrians, I see that Representative Jordan has a question. Would this be okay to interrupt you at this point in your presentation and take that? Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. The free-for-all style is just a little different, which is, it's not bad. But Ms. Adrian, sorry if I missed this.
Can you speak a little bit about why the shift from a 90% to a 10% and unpack that a little bit more for the committee? I'm a new member to this committee, so any background you have there to account for why that's happening would be extremely helpful to me.
Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Jordan. I might let Mr. Strom talk about that. He has a little bit more historical experience with the committee.
Okay, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, the shift in school funding is rather unique to that area of the budget. And we'll talk about this in some detail later this session. But when we refer to the total amount of aid that a district gets, it's called the aid entitlement. And that's split into two parts. 90% of that under current law is paid in the current year, and 10% is paid in the next year. And the reason for that is that school district characteristics change throughout the year, and essentially it allows us to make an adjustment as we get final data. So the shift has a purpose from that point of view, but it also has a purpose when the state's budget is in a bad situation. Because the state can't borrow, one of its, for purposes of funding a deficit, one of its tools that it may use is a school finance shift. And the long story short, the state essentially is on a cash basis and the school districts are on an accrual accounting basis. So the state can delay a payment to the school district and save money on a one-time basis by doing that. The school district is unaffected except for the delay in cash flow because the school district recognizes that money as essentially an accounts receivable. So the shift has the effect of providing the state, even though it can be painful for the charter schools and school districts, for the state to balance its budget in years when there's a significant financial downturn. We'll have more discussions about this. We've got a 5-page document on the House Research website that explains the school funding shifts in detail. But essentially, for your purposes and for Ms. Adrian's purposes on the budgeting worksheet, the appropriation number is always 90% of the amount we need to pay for the current year, plus the 10% that's remaining for the previous year. It's an accounting tool. The world would be a lot simpler for us all if we didn't have the shift, but it does both allow for these cleanup payments to be made when final data is known, and it also provides this additional budgeting tool for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Jordan, do you have a follow-up or is your...
I do, Madam
Chair. Okay, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom or anyone else, can you talk a little bit about what sorts of shifts would account for differences that you mentioned with that 10%? I assume enrollment is one of those things and student demographic data, but what are some other measurements that would account for us waiting for that additional, for that last 10%?
Madam, Mr. Strom, would you like that one?
Madam Chair, yes. Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, a couple things are going on. As Ms. Perra will talk about later today or tomorrow when we talk about student movement programs, Minnesota has a whole array of programs that allow students to attend in other districts. So the final number of students can vary. Bills for special services like special education can lag the year. The resident district is ultimately on the hook for these. So there's a lot of data that gets finalized as the school year goes on. One other thing to point out, and we'll talk about this when we get to the pupil counts, Minnesota uses a measure called average daily membership, which is like an FTE count. And so as the year's going on, the district may have in-migration for one reason or another, or may have students leaving the district. And all of these things allow the payment system then to be adjusted with this cleanup. Payment. Whether the 10% is the right amount or the state could get by with a 95-5 shift, that's a good question. But for most of the years, for the last 40 years, the shift has been at a 90%, 10% split. So you could look at whether maybe 2 or 3% is enough for that cleanup or 5%. There'd be a one-time cost if one went that direction. For a number of years, from 35 years past, beyond that, the shift was at 85-15. But for most of the recent years, it's been at 90-10, with the exception of the years where there's a budget deficit or a budget struggle.
Representative Jordan.
Yes, thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. And thank you as well, Mr. Strom, for walking us through all of this. I guess my final question, and then it's also clear to me that I'm happy to take some of these questions offline, but for my benefit, can you talk a little bit about if we've seen trends there with tuition billing between those districts and how that ultimately, and if and how that ultimately accounts for some of that discrepancy we see in these budgets and these shifts?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, we'll talk more about the tuition billing is a particular issue in the special education area, and we've got some slides on that later in the presentation, and I know Chair Dabney's intending some hearings later in the on the year that will touch on this as well. If I could, Madam Chair, one thing we can always do is provide more information to the member, or when a member requests, we can provide that information to the whole committee. For example, the committee administrator could send out this 5-page shift document to you all, and you can get a deeper look at that. And then all of us in the nonpartisan staff are happy to answer individual questions on that. Committee time can often mean that we can't have quite as detailed a discussion as we'd like, but we're certainly happy to address those and in whatever forum that works, whether it's with the whole committee or just with an individual member.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Strom. Right now, it looks like Representative Feist has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, you mentioned that the trends have been pretty stable in recent years, and so the shift has kind of been predictable. And I'm curious how the enrollment impact or the impact of the pandemic on enrollment has impacted the shift and if it's created any chaos and how it might impact the schools and their funding.
Representative or Madam Chair, Representative Feist, you're reading ahead. Tomorrow, the committee has arranged for the people who work on pupil projections at the MMB and MDE to come speak with us a bit about how the pandemic's affected enrollment. And we'll have some different documents for you then as well. But they'll do the experts will be here tomorrow, and they can tell us how they modeled the change in enrollment that each district is experiencing due to the pandemic.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Members, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, for brevity's sake, I know we've got some questions on our side as well, and we were hoping to just wait till the end so we can get through all the presentations. If I could just make a recommendation, perhaps we could do that so we don't have a whole plethora of questions in front of us. Having sat through these presentations, the staff is usually pretty thorough. So just a suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. At this time, Ms. Adrians, I'm not sure if you're continuing or if it's Mr. Strom, but I'll turn it over to your team.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few more points to make about the spreadsheet, if everyone is willing to indulge me. So as I was saying, with the gray shaded columns that show up, these are kind of the most useful columns to look at when members are trying to figure out where there have been changes in funding. Typically, there will be some difference between the end of session numbers and the forecasted numbers as we get those updates. Due to the pandemic, this has been a particularly unusual year, but even in normal times, that there will be changes in funding levels from biennium to biennium. And those reasons, kind of as Mr. Strom alluded to, there might be changes in forecasted program growth or decline. In this instance, you can see that there has been a reduction in the general education base of just over $80 million from biennium to biennium. Sometimes there are policy decisions that have been made previously where a program would sunset after a number of years, and that would cause a change in funding from year to year. Sometimes there are just differences, as we mentioned, the actual versus the expected expenditure levels. So that's another reason why it's really nice to have these these forecasts from time to time, because it gives us a better sense of where we are at with the funding levels and what the appropriate funding levels should be. The last thing that I'll mention is that even though we traditionally just use the November forecast numbers at this point in the legislative session, I've added a couple of columns at the end, and they're labeled the December fund balance. And what these reference is, there was, I put in a December update because there was legislation that was enacted in the December special session that resulted in an increase in spending in the general education base amount. So that $2.4 million was due to legislation for resulting around free and reduced lunch program. And so rather than just using the November forecast as our starting point, we will actually be using this December fund balance update, which is exactly the same as the November forecast, except for that $2.4 million increase. So now, members, so we've talked about the state aid from the general fund. And as I said before, schools also rely on property taxes for some of their revenue as well as state aid. Nearly 30% of all the property taxes that are raised in the state go to school districts. That amount ends up being around $3.3 billion for the taxes that were payable in 2020. And then property taxes, we also want to mention it makes up the second largest share of the school district's budget. So the state aid is that big bulk like we talked about, but the average school district receives about 20% of its revenue from the local property tax revenues. And to go back to kind of a higher level look at property taxes, this shows where the property tax revenue that that comes into the state, how it's spent, where it goes. So you can see that the county and school district pieces of that pie are pretty equal. So they're both about 30% get spent on both those areas. And then cities get about a quarter of the funding as well. And now, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Strom.
Okay, Mr. Strom, before you start, thank you very much, Ms. Adrians. I do want to encourage members, if you have questions, to speak up. There is a lot of information coming right now, and we do have quite a few new members on our committee. I just want to remind members of this committee, the information that is in our packet today isn't all going to be covered necessarily today. We still have a couple more hearings for this, and I give you my word, I will do my very best to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to ask their questions. So maybe better to take this a bite at a time instead of feeling completely overwhelmed. Any questions at this point from members? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the pie chart that was one slide ago, it showed 24% for the amount from, I think it was counties and cities or just cities. And if I could just look at that chart again, so that's like overall. And I was just curious if like within each school district that those percentages are just like dramatically different. Because I know that just the local taxes like affect the disparities in funding that we have between our school districts. And so I just wanted to make sure I understood. So that's 24% like just overall in the total percentage that goes averaged out between all the school districts, but that within each school district, it's like a dramatically different pie.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Mr. Strom or Ms. Adrians, I'll let you take, either one of you can take that.
Madam Chair, members, the Representative Feist, you're correct. There's two ways to look at this. The taxpayer in some parts of the state obviously may only be in a township, and so there wouldn't be any city taxes in that region. And the city tax rate varies dramatically amongst the cities. So when a property taxpayer is paying their tax bill, they'll be paying a tax that includes the city tax or the township tax, the county tax, the school district tax, and then sometimes either a special service district tax or a tax that's going into a tax financing fund. And those will vary dramatically. There are some, now the school district borders, one other thing we should point out, school district borders aren't necessarily coterminous with the city borders. And so, for example, in Columbia Heights, there may be a part of the school district that's outside of the city border of Columbia Heights. So two taxpayers in the same valued property may pay different overall property taxes, even though the school portion would be the same, because their city or county tax may vary. And Representative Joachim's committee spends a great deal of time on all of this, those jurisdictions, those parts of jurisdictions are referred to as unique taxing jurisdictions. So you may well be in the Hopkins School District, but in the city of Edina, in the Hennepin County District, and pay very different taxes than somebody that's in the Richfield part of the Edina School District. So there can be a whole range of variation in that tax rate, depending on where one lives. The school tax rates, and this is a little bit separate question from what you asked, but the school tax rates can also vary for neighbors who are in separate school districts. So for example, the city of Edina is actually in parts of 6 different school districts. Each of those school districts has a different tax rate. So the tax that you're paying to your city, your county, and your school may be different, even if you're in the same school district, because you may be in other jurisdictional boundaries.
Representative Feist, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. Mr. Strom, as a very sophisticated expert, I'm just curious, do you think that if we had a less complex system that we'd be able to more efficiently fund our schools and Mr. more Strom. Strategically fund our schools?
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, those are the kinds of questions that you as policymakers should address. My job's to describe the system we've got. If you go back to and no need to put this slide on the board, but if you go back to the chart that was on page 3 that Ms. Pera talked about, there are principles of school finance systems, and one of those is transparency. And obviously in Minnesota, this is a place where our school finance system is probably not very transparent. It may be that some of those other goals have been much more important than transparency. But we have a very complicated property tax system. We have 2 property tax bases, depending on what type of levy it is. We've got jurisdictional boundaries that change. Some members on this committee from Greater Minnesota know that they've got school districts that cross county borders. They've got school districts where they jog around little bits of cities. There are all sorts of boundary issues that go well beyond our school financing system that exists. Questions about whether 87 is the right number of counties or not. A number of years ago, there was a suggestion that Pine County split itself into 2 counties. There was a bill back in the 1970s that suggested maybe we should go to school district borders that align with county borders instead of having 330-some, and at that time it was about 500 school districts. Instead of having different school district and county borders, why not put those together? And those are all really good questions for you as policymakers to think about which kind of system makes sense. But as a staff person, we're glad to describe those to you, but it's really your decisions about what makes sense, whether perhaps equity as a goal in terms of fairness of tax rates is more important than transparency, or maybe the property tax system reflects a fairness amongst the types of property taxpayers that's more important than the simplicity of describing the system. So those are all really, really good questions for you to think about and really come up in the context of each of the formulas we'll discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Feist, any follow-up?
No, thank you so much for humoring me.
Absolutely. Mr. Strom, please continue.
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Adrian's talked about the aid programs that school districts face. The school districts are also subject to levy programs. Most of the levies are going to be set by the school board. There's a few that require the approval of the voters, but most of those levy formulas are set by the board, subject to the formulas that the state has put in place. And Minnesota has 30 different levy programs, each for a different purpose. Those amounts can vary greatly from district to district. As I mentioned, a few of those, the operating referendum, the bond sales, which are the bond elections for the sale of GO bonds for purposes of building new school buildings, and the capital projects levy, all three of those generally require voter approval. If you'll go to the separate sheet now to look at these different school levies, we've got these on one page for you, these 30 levies listed, and they're generally listed by fund by size. And you can see at the top of this sheet that Ms. Adrian's mentioned that the school levies for pay 20, and that's the payable year that goes with the 2021 school year, of $3.3 billion of school levies. That's property taxes paid in Minnesota that the county processing and provides to the school districts. 1.34 of those are on the tax base known as referendum market value, and about 60% of those, $1.96 billion, are on the net tax capacity tax base. When we look at the ones that are voter approved versus not voter approved, you can see that's at about an even split of about $1.6 billion each. When we look at those levies, as you go down the list, you can see the operating referendum where the taxpayers have gone to the polls in their school district to approve additional operating money is the single biggest operating levy. That's about $717 million. And then there are smaller ones as you go down the list, things like building lease and other capital. We have a small levy of about $36 million for safe schools purposes. And then as you go down toward the bottom of the list, you'll see some very specific levies for things like ice arenas and severance payments and a few other things. And so the legislature has decided that each of these programs is worthy of having a property tax levy as a part of it. If you look in the middle column, it's a numeric column that shows the number of districts that have each of those levies. You can see a few of them are just limited to very few school districts, while many of those levies are available to districts across the state. And then those last two columns, they show whether or not the levies equalized, and we'll talk about equalized levies a little later, and whether or not an election is required before that levy can be made. The takeaway from all of this, about 30 different levy programs. The formulas for those are set by you at the state, except for those where the voters approve an additional amount. And even those are somewhat constrained by the state in terms of limits on how big they can be. And those levies fall into the domain of this committee as it analyzes the school finance system. Ms. Adrians puts out a tracking worksheet, just like the aid worksheet, on the levy side, and has all the adjustments for each year as well. And you'll see that later in the committee as well. Well, the levy is not really a state source. It is in the jurisdiction of this committee, and it is up to this committee to determine whether the baseline levies are at the right level or not. Madam Chair, members, we could go on to the next slide here. I think we just talked about that one. When we look at that single page of levies, we can also put that in a pie chart for you. And you can see the relative shares as you go around the pie chart of the levies that are on referendum market value, the two categories on the right, top right side of the pie, and those that are on tax capacity for the rest of the pie. And then you can see the voter approved portions in the two categories at the top of the pie. You can move on now to the next slide. Ms. Adrians, I'll start.
Madam Chair and members, we, as mentioned, school districts do receive some portion of their revenue from the federal government. And so in fiscal year 2021, it was about 5% of the total revenue is to be expected to come from federal government. Now this amount doesn't include any funds that are related to the COVID-19 funds. And I believe the department will be coming in and they will talk more about what their expectations are about the funding that will come that's related to COVID. And so that will be in addition to this 5% of revenue and from the federal government. These federal funds, they are primarily made up of funding for Title I services. Those are funds that are directed at schools with higher counts of kids from low-income families, for example. There's some money for special education services, and then also for food and nutrition programs. And so the pie chart on the next page kind of shows how that breakdown looks. So the bulk of the federal money goes to nutrition services, about 36%. And then special education is 25%. And then Title I funding and then other programs is the resulting or the remaining 40%. School districts also receive some of their funding from other local funds. These are things like transfers among other school districts, fees for student activities, such as, school games when tickets are sold for the football games or concessions, that sort of thing. Any sales that are for school meals. So for the free and reduced lunch price lunches, that this is separate from that, but so more the traditional fees that they can charge for students, that is money that goes to the school districts. And then there are taconite funds and other county apportionments that schools receive as revenue sources as well.
Ms. Adrians, I see that Representative Jordan has a question. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Adrians, can you also talk about school trust lands and the impact that revenue generated from those lands has on our local? I know that's another area that I think we sometimes forget about, especially some of my metro colleagues we tend to forget about. But can you talk a little bit about what that revenue is and where it comes from and the impact it has on our budget?
Great question, Representative Jordan. Thank you for that. Ms. Adrians.
Madam Chair and Representative Jordan, that is a good question. And I might let Mr. Strom chime in here, but I think you're referencing the permanent school fund revenue that that the schools received. So that is an amount that is set aside that is just for the school districts. And so I think the amount that the schools were receiving, it's in the like $36 to $40 million range that gets allocated to school districts. So the each district receives an amount that's equal among all districts. So it's about $42 per student goes out for that amount. And Mr. Strom, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, the permanent school fund is composed of the revenue that goes into the fund from certain minerals activities and forestry activities. More than 70% of that money has come from minerals activity, primarily from the taconite and prior to that, the iron ore mining in northern Minnesota. Those funds go into a trust, and it's the interest and dividends on the trust, which is referred to as the permanent school fund, that's paid to school districts each year. Since 2010, those payments have been additional money to school districts. Prior to that point in time, they were simply an offset to each district's other state aid. But the permanent school fund, as Ms. Adrian said, that's now a direct payment, and she had the sizes of those for you. We've got a separate worksheet we'd be glad to share with you that shows the payments over time to school districts from the trust. There's also, because of the way the trust is managed, there's a lot of interest in this fund on the DNR, the committees that deal with the DNR. And there's an office of the trust there's as well. And that office includes links to the biennial reports, which talk about which sources of revenue, the forestry and the mining and how they contribute to that fund. So those are resources that are available, but the output of that is relatively limited currently, at, as Ms. Adrian said, about $42 per pupil that's distributed to school districts and charter schools throughout the state on a per pupil basis.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Any follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. That was very helpful.
Thank you. Ms. Adrians, if you'd like to continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think now I'm ready to turn it over to Mr. Strom.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, we'll go to slide 20 now. And we want to give you a little context. You're going to pick this up elsewhere. But Ms. Adrians had some charts earlier in the presentation she described about the state general fund budget. And it's really important, we think, for members of this committee to have an understanding of that budget because it helps frame in your minds the portions of that 42% of the general fund budget that get paid out to school districts. One of the ways to look at that information is to look at the forecast briefings, which come out twice a year in November and February, and look at the balance in the revenue and spending. And this is a chart that I think is particularly instructive because it allows members to see how resources are changing between the biennium that's just ending, the 2020-21 biennium, and next biennium, the one you're going to be budgeting for, the 22-23 biennium. And these amounts are shown in millions of dollars. You can see that the beginning balance for the biennium that we're just finishing up came in at $3.97 billion. That the spending was $47.6 billion, and that the revenue was $47.1 million. So in the current biennium, that number following those lines, $527 million more spending than revenue took place. And now if you look to the right, you'll see that same number absent under the baseline budget, absent any changes. The difference between spending and revenue is $1.6 billion. The state's going to be spending $1.6 billion more than the revenue coming in. You can go down below then and see the budget before reserves. And basically what you can see is that budget before reserves is going to be going down because of the way that the spending versus revenue portion looks. Now, the Ways and Means Committee will spend a great deal of time with this. You'll all have debates on the House floor about how best to do this. But for purposes of putting the budget in context, I think it's really helpful to be able to identify that gap between revenue and spending. Next slide, please. And if I could add one more thing about that, when the Department of Management and Budget comes in tomorrow, they'll also be able to speak in great detail about the overall state budget picture. Next, let's move on and talk a bit about Minnesota's school finance formulas. These formulas are all in the context of this overall budget situation at the state level and in the context of you as Education Finance Committee members responsible for setting both those aid and levy amounts. Remember again that there are those principles of school finance systems that you're going to be thinking about as you look to adjust any of these funding levels. For most of those formulas that we've talked about, those 50 plus aid formulas and those 30 plus levy formulas, they generally fall into one of three categories. The most common and the largest of these categories is distributing money to school districts, charter schools based on the number of pupils that are served by that district. There are also a second type of formulas, which are often referred to as cost reimbursement or partial cost reimbursement formulas, and special education funding is an example of that, where some portion of the school districts and charter schools' costs are being funded through a reimbursement based on prior year spending. And then there are essentially those voter-approved revenue amounts on top of the formula amounts. And the three areas where your school districts can hold a referendum are for operating purposes, the ones at the November general election, and then for debt service amounts necessary for school building bonds. This is when a major building or remodeling project takes place in your school district. Usually the mechanism for funding that is that the district goes to the voters and has the voters approve the sale of general obligation bonding. And the bonds then are used to pay for the facility. And over the next 20 years, the district annually levies to repay those bonds. And then finally, there's a smaller referendum that the voters may approve for projects that include capital projects and technology projects. As I mentioned in that first category, the The main way that these aid and levy programs work is funding on a per pupil basis. And for that reason, how we count pupils is very important. We'll talk more with the MDE tomorrow, the Department of Education, about the mechanism for pupil counting and how they think the pupils are going to be different because of the pandemic. But I wanted to point out a few things to you. The first of those is that when we count pupils in Minnesota, we generally count by adjusted average daily membership. And that's really a count of the students served at each school site. We start with the average daily membership, which is like an FTE count. It counts the kids that are enrolled in the district all through the school year. So if a student's there all year, they're going to count as one student in average daily membership. If they're going to be there for part of the year, maybe they move to the district in March, they'll count for the 3 months that they're in the school or the 4 months that they're in school from March until the end of the year. So that's the starting place, is counting the pupils. It's really a count of every day's presence on the school rolls. It's not an attendance count, so it doesn't reduce the funding if a student misses school for a day or is out for sick. It only matters if the student is enrolled there. We then take that count of students and we weight it by grade level. And the students in grades K to 6 are weighted as 1.0, and secondary students are weighted at 20% more. So each secondary student in your school district or charter school counts as 20% more than an elementary student. Those weightings used to be quite a bit more spread out. Secondary pupils, when I first started, were weighted at 1.4. That weighting has fallen over time. And a few years ago, the department reran an analysis and determined that schools are now spending as much on elementary pupils, or almost as much on elementary pupils, as secondary pupils, but our funding system still weights the secondary pupils at 1.2.
Mr. Strom, if I may just take a break right here for a moment. I see Representative Jordan has a question.
Yeah.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will be a quick one. Mr. Strom, can you talk about how ABE students or ECFE also contributes to, and how those pupils and how that those services relate to our school funding formula, obviously?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan, yes, we do use other kinds of counts as well. And so for the ECFE program, the district's actually being funded on a formula based at the count of the number of students that are below the age of 5 that are resident to the school district. That formula is roughly $150 times those number of pupils. We've got printouts that we can share with you, and the school finance guidebook has an explanation of how that works. For the adult basic education program, that's more like a cost reimbursement program in some ways, in that that's based on the hours of what we refer to as contact services. So the number of hours instruction provided to ABE students is the biggest part of that formula. That formula, the AB adult basic education formula, has got a variety of twists and turns, but it's got 4 major components to it. And most school districts in the ABE area are in a consortium, so the funding is usually paid to one district of the consortium, and the consortium often has private partners as well who are helping with the adult education program. Both of those, though, are not based on the student count. Those are based on either the count of contact hours in the case of ABE, or in the ECFE's case, on the number of 0 to 4-year-olds in the district.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And I just want to say thank you to the nonpartisan staff. We're kind of used to kicking around different acronyms, and we may be familiar with those, but not everybody is. And so when you describe them, just like you did, Mr. Strom, that's very helpful. Thank you for that. Any follow-up, Representative Jordan? Very good. Mr. Strom, please continue.
So, Madam Chair, the next chart on page 23 of the PowerPoint gives you some sense of how pupil counts have changed over time. And we'll talk about the dip in pupil counts that's happening because of the pandemic separately tomorrow. But this chart tries to give you some sense of how all of the school kids in Minnesota's enrollment has changed since 1960 to the end of the period that we'll be responsible for in the budgeting this time around, which is through fiscal year 23, and then for what we call the tails portion of budgeting for fiscal years 24 and 25. And what I'd like to point out on this chart is you can see how dramatically the growth due to the baby boom was in school enrollment. On the top line there, the dark line is public school enrollment. You can see it grew from 671,000 to almost 922,000 students over a period of about 12 years. And then it fell pretty dramatically too. Now, the important point to mention about this is because we have a school finance system that funds on the number of pupils, when the pupil count is growing statewide, it requires an additional amount of money just to provide the same level of support per pupil. When the pupil count is falling, those are really salad days for the legislature. They may be very hard on local districts, but for the legislature, there's fewer pupils to fund each year. And so those boom and bust cycles in enrollment tend to very much drive how the legislature can respond to individual program requests in the school area. The top line splits apart. As members know, in 1991, charter schools were created in Minnesota. The first several years, there were very few students enrolled, but you can see that dotted line on the top shows the overall enrollment in the public system, with the dark line being those in the traditional school district. So the gap between those two lines is the charter school amount. And you can see in fiscal year 25, the last year listed there, it's our estimate that there'll be about 82,000 students in the charter school system and about 805,000 in the traditional public school district system. Separately, at the bottom of the chart, there's two lines that are important for you as well. The dashed line is the non-public, traditional non-public enrollment line. And you can see that the drop in enrollment that happened with the baby boom for publics also happened, but starting a little earlier in the 1960s with the traditional non-public schools, as their enrollment fell from a peak of 158,000 pretty steeply, and then has had very gradual decline since that time. And you can see we've only got data through fiscal year 20 for the non-publics. We don't estimate that out as part of our forecasting, but there are currently 65,657 traditional non-public students. And then in Minnesota, the bottom line there is the number of homeschool pupils. And while you can see that this line started in 1987, that's only because that was the first year that the mandatory reporting was required. And there's some sense that during those first 10 years after the reporting started, that significant growth in the number of non-public or of homeschoolers was due to more reporting compliance. Since that time, since the early 2000s on to 2020, you can see a slight growth each year in the number of homeschool pupils. And again, that's just through fiscal year 20. So that's sort of the sum total of enrollment for Minnesota over the last 60 years.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I see Representative Drazkowski has his hand up. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Mr. Strom, looking at that chart, I'm curious, with the governor's actions in this pandemic, what we're seeing, what I'm hearing is some families who have been homeschooling their kids more families that have been, and more of a trend towards or away from the public school. When is this data sampled, and when will we actually see the most current data? And if there has been any impact from this pandemic reaction or not?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, tomorrow. the Department of Education is going to be with us tomorrow, and they've got a breakdown that they used in the November forecast that shows for us how the enrollment changed for the numbers reported this fall. And then more importantly, I think for you as policymakers, how they're predicting that enrollment changes going on into the future. The chart that was just up on the screen does have that drop in it, but it's small enough in the scheme of things that it doesn't, for the public system, that it doesn't show up very well. And on the charts you'll see tomorrow,
from the Department of Education, you'll see in detail how that drop looks. And they'll talk about the drop at the kindergarten grades versus some of the other. And then they can talk, and it'd be a really good place to ask a question tomorrow about how they predicted whether those students will be returning to the public system and how many years out it'll be. So we'll have a very good presentation from the experts tomorrow on that.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Drazkowski, any follow-up?
No, that does it. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
You're welcome. I see that Chair Dabney has joined us. Chair Dabney, would you like your gavel back at this point?
From all reports, Chair Sanstead, you've been doing a heck of a job. So
we'll continue.
Continue. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members. So the change that we saw on page 23 showed the enrollment in total. On page and just one last thing. Oops, I'm sorry, Ms. Bird. On 23. It's, you can see that downtick right there, yep, where the pointer is or the hand is. It's not very pronounced on this, but tomorrow that's where you'll see the drop due to the pandemic. And then when we come to the bottom, the state's very close to finalizing the fall enrollment numbers, which is where the homeschool and non-public count comes from 21. And I'll be very interested to see how the enrollment there has changed. By all appearances, those numbers should click up. The 65,000 should be up, I would guess. We'll hear from the department tomorrow about that. But both that 65,000 number and the 20,000 pupil number in the homeschools will be clicking up on the data that they show us if they've got that ready by tomorrow. When we talk about the change in enrollment, though, the underlying demographics have also changed fairly dramatically. One of the things we can look at, we have counts from the fall enrollment that allow us to look at several kinds of ways, demographic ways to analyze student counts. You can see on the dark line on the top there that we use a measure of free and reduced lunch for a variety of formulas, not just the meal formulas, but also compensatory revenue. And you can see that grew pretty steadily from 1999 up through about 2014, and then has been decreasing since then with a sharper decrease in the last 2 years here. That maxed out in 2015 at 38.3% of the students in our public school system eligible for free or reduced price meals. The purple line that's dashed with the dots between it is the students of color and American Indian students. And you can see that number increased from about 15% in 1999 up to about 35% for the current year. And that's been a pretty much, you can see the slope of that line's been pretty consistent over that time period. The next line is the dotted green dotted line for special education students. And you can see here that the number has grown from 12.3% up to about 16%. When we talk about our special education enrollment, we use a count that we refer to as the unduplicated child count, which is taken as of December 1st. And so if a student's in any disability category, the major disability category they're in is listed, and then they're not duplicated in that count, you can see that enrollment hasn't grown all that much, but the cost of services has grown pretty dramatically. And some of the categories within the 13 special education categories have also grown pretty dramatically over this time period. And then the last line on the chart is the red line at the bottom of the chart. And this shows the number of English learner students in Minnesota. You can see that this growth has been pretty substantial from about 3.7 in 1999 to about 8.5% of the state's public school enrollment. You can see it's been fairly flat over the last 5 or 6 years. The English learner enrollment is counted for the number of years that the students are served. There's a test called the Access Test, which is essentially the measure of whether a student needs another year of English learner education or not. And when we talk about formulas, you'll see a spreadsheet about this, and we'll have some detailed information as well. One last thing to add is both in Greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area, the enrollment of students who are English language learners tends to be very uneven. So in some parts of Greater Minnesota, there may be a very heavy percentage of students that are English learners, where in a community next door or two communities over, that's not the case. And the same holds true in the suburban districts. There are some suburban districts very close to others that have a small English learner population, where the neighboring district has quite a large population. So when we look on a district by district level, we'll see a lot of variation in English learners, relatively little variation in special education counts for the majority of districts, some substantial variation in the students of color, and some substantial variation in students eligible for free or reduced price meals. Minnesota's enrollment can also be seen in a regional perspective. This chart shows fiscal year 20 enrollment by region. If you use the economic development regions of the state and lump them together to the regions we would call the service co-op regions, you can see that the metro area, which is the 7-county metro area, has about 55% of the student population. And it was only in about 2004 that the majority of the students were in the metropolitan area. Prior to that time, the majority of students had been in Greater Minnesota. And then you can see the enrollment for those other regions throughout the state as you go around the top of the pie chart there. Most of those regions have been losing in terms of total enrollment at a relatively slow rate over the last 10 years. A few of those, like the East Central region, have been growing over that same period. And you could see those trends on the overall enrollment as well. We can also look at enrollment by size of school district. This is the next slide that's in the packet. And if you divide the 330 school districts into quintiles, that is into 5 equal shares, you can see that the 67 smallest school districts in the state make up about 2% of the population. They have about 17,000 students in them. The next quintile, the 66 next smallest school districts, have about 4% of the student population. The middle percentile has about 8% of the student population. And then you can see at the end, the largest percentile, the 66 largest school districts of the state, have about 70% of the overall enrollment. Now, one of the reasons that this graph is helpful is to keep in mind that we have 330 school districts that are very, very different. They're geographically different, but they're also different on the basis of size. And as you go back to those principles of school finance, one of the things that, as you think about districts, it may be that a very small or a very large district has different needs than a medium-sized school district. Some of the formulas that we have reflect geographic patterns. Some of those also, in fact, are impacted by enrollment patterns that that you can see on this size chart here. Madam Chair, I think we'll move on next to general education revenue. I just was taking a look at the time here. Would you prefer us to stop here? This may be a good stopping place for tomorrow. I'll leave that to you, but if you may want to take a few questions as we'll sort of have a big chunk of information with general education revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Members, we have just about 10 minutes, if my clock is correct, remaining for this committee hearing. I know Representative Krisha, earlier you said your members had questions. I don't see any hands up right now, but if there are questions, this would be a perfect time to take some. Going once, going twice. Representative Krisha.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, 10 minutes isn't enough for us to get into all of our discussions. We decided we'll wait till tomorrow when we have a more lengthy and can be all coordinated. So just to help the staff out.
Very good. I just wanted to make sure you had the opportunity. Mr. Strom, we have about 10 minutes left. Would you like to proceed?
Madam Chair, sure. I think Ms. Adrians is going to start our discussion of general education revenue. And we'll pull a printout up out on the screen after she gets started, and then That'll set the stage for where we begin tomorrow after we hear from MMB and MDE.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we've sort of talked about the sources of revenues for school districts, we'll start by talking about general education revenue. School districts, they're required to spend some of the funds that they receive in a specific manner, but the general education funds are not typically designated for such specific uses. So school boards have some discretion as to how to best use these funds for each of their individual districts. The school finance guides that were referenced at the beginning of the presentation go into a lot of detail about all of the different calculations that go into the general education revenue. So there's a lot of good historical information. There are calculations of each of the formulas so that you can see some examples of how the funding gets distributed under each of those different components. We talked a little bit about the different runs that we'll distribute for the committee throughout the session. So we have these, as we said before, we have these district by district printouts that we'll refer to as runs. And it's nice because it allows members to kind of see how their individual districts are like how the different formulas interact for their districts. And so we will, again, I think we said before that we typically put those in numerical order. So it's nice if you know the number of your school districts to be able to quickly find them, but we're happy to sort those in any way that would be convenient for people. School districts are the way that they do their accounting of their revenue and expenditures. There are certain requirements that we have for the school districts and of the school statewide accounting system, and it's called UFARS. I off the top of my head, I cannot remember what that acronym stands for. It's Mr. Strom, can you remind us?
Madam Chair, the Uniform Financial Accounting and Reporting System is UFARS.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had the uniform part, and that was about all my brain could come up with. The agency uses that accounting system, and they might make reference to that from time to time. And so within that, and we will have printouts occasionally of the general fund, or it'll show up as the operating fund for school districts. And what that includes is such items like the general education aid, the special education aid, and any other instructional or student support revenue programs that might be included in there. There are some, you know, I mentioned that there are some things that are sometimes revenue is designated and sometimes it's not. And typically the general fund is pretty wide open for districts, but there are some accounts in there that are reserved. An example of that is staff development funds. They're required to set aside 2% of the basic formula amount for staff development purposes. And there are other accounts for which the revenue was intended that they have to spend money on the services for those things. So such as special education, that's a really big obvious example. But as I said, the majority of this, their operating fund or their general fund, it's not reserved. So the local school boards and the districts have a lot of discretion over how to spend that money best for their purposes. And then
go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this chart shows is this is a nice historical look at how the average per pupil amount of general fund revenue over time has changed. So the dotted line, which is the state aid portion, you can see, so this goes back to 2003, it was just under $10,300 per pupil or for that ADM that Mr. Strom talked about. And you can see that over time, um, for, for that state aid portion, as well as the levy amount, which is the red dotted line at the bottom, and those amounts totaled, there has been a slight but an overall increase in the average amount per pupil. So it was just over the total of the levy portion and the state aid amount was just over $11,000 per pupil back in 2003. And in 2021, it's up to $13,400. And then, Madam Chair and members, the next chart shows the general education revenue by component for this school year or the fiscal year 2021. So the amount that the school districts received, this $8.8 billion, you can see that the biggest part of the pie chart is that basic formula aid. So we mentioned that before, that it's over 70% of it, and it's the amount that it's pretty flexible, I guess I would say, for districts to spend. And then after that, for the other, or this is within that, I'm sorry, within that general education revenue amount, there are different things. Like you can see the compensatory makes up about, the compensatory revenue makes up about 6%. And then the referendum and local optional, those are 8% and 7%. So they're all the formulas, you know, contribute to this in little ways, but that basic funding formula where the amount per pupil is about $6,500 per pupil, that makes up the bulk of the general education revenue amount for districts.
Okay, Ms. Adrians, at this time, I think that we're going to have to pause. And I just want to say a very special thank you to all of the fiscal analyst team and to our nonpartisan research for this very in-depth and thorough overview today. Members, tomorrow we are going to continue working through the documents that you've received, and we'll also have an overview from MMB and MDE. That relates to the forecast budgeting process. And members, with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.